Chapter 25 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 25. While Wilde was with me at Naples, he was in good health and good spirits. He was chiefly engaged in finishing his Ballad of Reading Gaol, of which he had concluded the rough draft at Berneval. He worked at it very hard, thus bearing out the contention I have always made, that all good poetry is the result of struggle and effort, and that good poets do not pour out words like inspired gramophones. I have been reminded of his struggles to get the ballad just right by reading the collection of his letters to Robert Ross, written from my villa at Posilippo, Naples, recently brought out by Mr. Moore Adie. En passant, I note that he refers in eulogistic terms to three sonnets called A Triad of the Moon, which I wrote at that time and which appeared in The City of the Soul, and have been reprinted in subsequent volumes. He says in the first letter in the collection, "Bosey has written three lovely sonnets, which I have called The Triad of the Moon. They are quite wonderful. He has sent them to Henley. I have also got him to send his sonnet on Mozart to the musician." I had forgotten till I read this letter that it was Oscar who gave me the name Triad of the Moon for my three sonnets. I had also forgotten all about the sonnet on Mozart. I now remember quite well writing it, but I cannot recall more than two lines of it. All I know is that the musician evidently did not publish it. In view of Wilde's contemptuous remarks about my undergraduate verse, made when he was in a rage, and quoted by Harris, I am glad to have this independent evidence that he did not always despise my poetry. It is instructive to note, from what he says in these letters, that my influence over him in the poetical line prevailed over that of Ross in at least two instances. Ross objected to his fine phrase for a judge, "the man in red who reads the law," in the Ballad of Reading Gaol, saying it made him think of "the man in blue" for a policeman. It was I who insisted on Wilde keeping in the expression and overruling Ross's foolish objection. Again, Ross said that the poem ought to end at the words, "Outcasts always mourn." Wilde says in one letter to Ross, "You are quite right in saying that the poem should end at outcasts always mourn, but the propaganda, which I desire to make, begins there." The fact is that Ross was a poor critic, and if he had had his way, he would have spoiled the Ballad of Reading Gaol, which is the only entirely fine and sincere poem Wilde wrote, forgetting his art for art's sake heresies, which Ross encouraged. It was I again who influenced him here. If the poem had ended at the point suggested by Ross, it would have been a heavy loss to literature. It is exceedingly lucky that I happened to be with Wilde at the time he finished writing this fine poem, far the best thing he ever did in poetry, for otherwise he would certainly have succumbed to some of Ross's inept attacks on his best phrases. "The black dock's dreadful pin," he defends against Ross, and he kept it in spite of Ross's efforts to make him change it. It is a fine phrase. His struggles, and his astonishingly humble pleas to be allowed to write his own poem in his own way, remind one of Byron's similar pleas on behalf of Don Juan, when it was continually being assailed by the mediocrities who assembled to criticise it, canto by canto, as Byron sent it in Murray's back parlour. I do not for a moment claim that I helped Wilde to write this great poem. I can recall only one passage which owed something to a sonnet, unpublished, of mine, which I had written while Oscar was in prison, and which I showed him at that time. It had two lines, "Into the dreadful town, through iron doors, by empty stairs and barren corridors." Those who know the Ballad of Reading Gaol well will recognise that there is an echo of these two lines in the ballad. "That night, the empty corridors," etc., etc. Wilde apologised for borrowing, and I assured him he was quite welcome, and I meant it. That is the only passage which owed anything at all to me, except that I, as a fellow poet, for whom he really had a respect as a poet, stiffened him against the clever criticisms of Ross. All I did was to maintain, then, as I would now against all comers, that Wilde was a much better judge of what is and what is not proper to a poem than Ross, who could not have written a dozen lines of poetry to save his life, and whose critical faculty can be gauged by the fact that he considered Shakespeare very much overrated, and inferior not only to Marlowe, but also to Webster. I'm afraid that my reminiscences of life at the Posilippo Villa are very vague. I remember that we had a cook called Carmine, a maid, Maria, and two boys called Peppino and Michele, who waited on us. Servants cost little more than their keep in those days at Naples, and the cost of feeding Wilde and myself and the servants was about 12 francs a day. I also remember that the villa, which was charmingly situated, with a terrace and marble steps leading down to the sea, was full of rats, so much so that I, who have always been terrified of rats, and, if the truth must be told, not by any means exactly mad about mice, was reduced to the ludicrous pass of having to hire a room in a house opposite the villa to sleep in. After a time, however, we got rid of the rats, partly by means of a professional and orthodox rat catcher, but also, and chiefly, according to Oscar's opinion, owing to the ministrations, hired for a small fee, of a potent witch, who was recommended as infallible by Michele, and who came and burned odours and muttered incantations, which she assured us no rats could resist. She also told both our fortunes, and Oscar professed to regard her as a wonderful and powerful sorceress. In appearance, she was quite the witch of literature and drama. She had a distinct beard, and, with age and envy, was grown into a hoop. Anyhow, the rats disappeared, and I was able to return to the villa, where I remained till I was obliged to leave because my allowance was threatened with extinction if I remained longer with Wilde. It was after I left him in possession of my villa, and with £200 of my money in his pocket, that he penned his celebrated letter to Ross, to which I have already referred, in which he says that, "As soon as there was no money left, Bosie left me," and describes the incident as "the most bitter experience of a bitter life." Considering that I was forced to leave him, much against my will, and that he, for his part, was also threatened with the loss of his pittance of £3 a week from his wife if he continued to live with me, and that, consequently, we both agreed that it was necessary to separate, this letter is one of the most astonishing products that the history of literature has ever recorded. The letter is not included in Mr. Adey's collection, called After Berneval, but it is now being offered for sale, with my consent, by Messrs. De Lau of 32 Old Bond Street. As an example of the amount of reliance which can be placed on Wilde's statements, spoken or written, it is perhaps the most powerful piece of evidence in my favour that the whole of this melancholy history of our friendship can provide. I commend it to those who go on refusing to believe that anyone could possibly have behaved so badly as I accuse Wilde and Ross of having done. I include Ross because he used the letter against me at the ransom case, although he knew perfectly well, and had known all along, what were the true facts, and that I was not only innocent of the slightest offence against Wilde, but treated him with the greatest generosity, and was also heartbroken at being obliged to leave him. End of chapter 25.